Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Walcott. It often happens in academic life that one is called upon to say wonderful things about a speaker. And again, it often happens that one is called upon to say things that could be described at best as hyperbole and at worst as hypocritical. I have found myself on occasion standing in front of a hall introducing the world's greatest expert in something or other and later thanking them for a magnificent paper, which everybody knows has been third rate. So for once, this is an enormous pleasure to be able to stand here and to say with real honesty that the man that I'm introducing to you tonight actually is one of the world's greatest literary figures. No hyperbole, no hypocrisy, he just is. He's a magnificent writer with a whole string of major awards, including, of course, the Queen's Gold Medal for Poetry, which he won in 1988, the first Commonwealth citizen to be awarded this, and in 1992, the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's a man of many interests. He has his first degree from the University of the West Indies. I won't tell you the date. And he's taught in schools in St. Lucia, in Grenada, in Jamaica College, Jamaica, and in recent years has lectured in prestigious universities all over the United States and around the world. In 1958, he founded the Trinidad Theatre Workshop, and then in 1962, published In a Green Night, the first of many award-winning, wonderful books. My personal favorite, and I'm very delighted and actually really rather nervous at the possibility of finally meeting him, is Homeros, the poem published in 1990 that transforms ordinary people into figures of epic. I think that we can safely say that this poem, together with Joyce's Ulysses, will have provided countless PhD students with an infinity of material for many, many years to come. His stage version of the Odyssey was commissioned by the Royal Shakespeare Company, and I'm told that a new volume of collected essays has just appeared, published by Faber. I don't think that you need to hear any more from me. I think that I will now hand over to Mr. Derek Walcott, one of the giants of 20th century literature, and like you, I'm going to enjoy the next hour enormously. Thank you.
You have to help me here because I think from where I was sitting, it sounded very echoey. Could someone at the back tell me that if I read at this level, because I intend to sit, if it's clear? And the gentleman way up at the back, how is it? How is it? Is it really okay or is it blurry? It's okay? I can trust you? I also have a cold, so please, it's very surprising to come to England and catch a cold. But I had it in Germany, it's not your fault. A lot of people here tonight, this evening, so it's more intimate than usual. I'm trying to do something that maybe has an arc to it, some range over the years. This first poem is called A Letter from Brooklyn. Sometimes in life you may get a letter from someone who's not a writer, someone who has so much sincerity of pain or of love or affection or just of observation, that a phrase can stay in your head from someone who has no pretext, no pretensions about being a writer. And a long time ago, when I began to, well, not when I began to write, but a long time ago, I got this letter from a woman who knew my father, who was who painted and all, was very gifted as a draftsman, and also wrote light verse and did some theatricals as well at home in Castries in St. Lucia. I didn't know my father. He died when I was a year old, and I have a twin brother, but my mother continually kept his memory alive in the house. And this lady knew him and just wrote this letter to me, probably because she knew that I was beginning to write. And I was very shaken by the letter. And the thing that really shook me is when she writes that he was buried, he's 28 years buried, meaning I must have been, I don't know, then 29 maybe. And she says, with this simplicity that you get from someone who's just writing simply, the real simplicity of... Have we gone off? Hello? Hello? Oh, we're on? She says, he was called home and is, I am sure, doing greater work. The knockout phrase, doing greater work, you know. It's like when you get to heaven, you can really start doing something serious. An old lady writes me in a spidery style, each character trembling, and I see a veined hand, pellucid as paper, traveling on a skein of such frail thoughts, its thread is often broken, or else the filament from which a phrase is hung dims to my sense, but caught, it shines like steel, as touch a line and the whole web will feel. She describes my father, yet I forget her face more easily than my father's yearly dying. Of her I remember small buttoned boots and the place she kept in our wooden church on those Sundays whenever her strength allowed. Gray-haired, thin-voiced, perpetually bowed. I am Mabel Rollins, she writes, and know both your parents. He is dead, Miss Rollins, but God bless your tents. Your father was a dutiful, honest, faithful, and useful person. For such plain praise, what fame is recompense? A horn painter, he painted delicately on horn. He used to sit around the table and paint pictures. The peace of God needs nothing to adorn it, nor glory, nor ambition. He is 28 years buried, she writes. He was called home, and is, I am sure, doing greater work. The strength of one frail hand in a dim room somewhere in Brooklyn, patient and assured, restores my sacred duty to the word. Home, home, she can write, with such short time to live, alone as she spins the blessings of her years, not withered of beauty, if she can bring such tears, nor withdrawn from the world that breaks its lovers so. Heaven is to her the place where painters go, all who bring beauty on frail shell or horn. There was all made, thence their looks mundi drawn, drawn, drawn till the thread is resilient steel, lost though it seems in darkening periods, and there they return to do work that is God's. So this old lady writes, and again I believe, I believe it all, and for no man's death I grieve. The next poem of Sea Shanty is simply a litany in praise of those astonishingly calm and radiant Sunday mornings you can get in the Caribbean, where everything is quiet, and if you walk along a dock or along a beach, you'll see the yachts and schooners at anchor in a very quiet light. So this is a litany of islands, as if it were alphabetically a prayer. There's a resemblance to the curve of the Antilles that may be similar to the blessing of saying a rosary as Columbus proceeds down the arc of the islands. The epigraph is from Baudelaire. La tout corde et beauté luxe calme et volupté. Anguilla, Adina, Antigua, Canel, Andrei, all the L's, voyelles of the liquid Antilles. The names tremble like needles of anchored frigates, yachts tranquil as lilies in ports of calm coral. The lithe ebony hulls of straight stitching schooners, the needles of their masts that thread archipelagos, refracted embroidery in feverish waters of the seafarers' islands, their shorn leaning palms, shaft of Odysseus, cyclopic volcanoes creak their own histories in the peace of green anchorage. Flight and Phyllis returned from the Grenadines. Names enter this Sabbath in the port clerk's register. Their baptismal names, the sea's liquid letters, Rapo, Donea, Sea, and their blazing cargoes of charcoal and oranges, quiet the fury of their ropes. Daybreak is breaking on the green chrome water. The white herons of yachts are at Sabbath communion. The histories of schooners are murmured in coral, their cargoes of sponges on sand spits of islets, barks white as white salt of acrid Saint Martin, hulls crusted with barnacles, holes foul with great turtles whose shipboys have seen the blue heave of Leviathan, a seafaring Christian and intrepid people. Now an apprentice washes his cheeks with salt water and sunlight. In the middle of the harbor, a fish breaks the Sabbath with a silvery leap. The scales fall from him in a tinkle of church bells. The town streets are orange with the weak, ripened sunlight. Balanced on the bowsprit, a young sailor is playing his grandfather's shanty on a trembling mouth organ. The music curls, dwindling like smoke from blue galleys to dissolve near the mountains. The music uncurls with the soft vowels of inlets, the christening of vessels, the titles of portages, the colors of sea grapes, the tartness of sea almonds, the alphabet of church bells, the peace of white horses, the pastures of ports, the litany of islands, the rosary of archipelagos, Anguilla, Antigua, Virgin of Guadeloupe, and stone white Grenada of sunlight and pigeons, the Amen of calm waters, the Amen of calm waters, the Amen of calm waters. Blues. Those five or six young guys hunched on the stoop that oven-hot summer night whistled me over, nice and friendly, so I stop. MacDougall or Christopher Street in chains of light. A summer festival or some saints. I wasn't too far from home, but not too bright for a nigger and not too dark. I figured we were all one, WAP, nigger, Jew. Besides, this wasn't Central Park. I'm coming on too strong. You figure right. They beat this yellow nigger black and blue. Yeah, during all this care, in case one used a knife, I hung my olive green just-bought sports coat on a fire plug. I did nothing. They fought each other, really. Life gives them a few kicks, that's all, the spades, the spicks. My face smashed in, my bloody mug pouring, my olive branch jacket saved from cuts and tears, I crawled 4 flights upstairs. Sprawled in the gutter, I remember a few watchers waved loudly and one kid's mother shouting like, Jackie or Terry, now that's enough. It's nothing really, they don't get enough love. You know they wouldn't kill you just playing rough like young American will. Still, it taught me something about love. If it's so tough, forget it. It's sort of amusing to look back this far and think that I was in a kind of mild panic, as probably a lot of men here, some men here might be, although it's too early for that, to have a sort of a poem of crisis about nearing 40. Big deal. This is for John Figaro, who's long past 40 and sitting down there. I prefer sometimes mistakes to accuracy. I think it's nicer to say conventional rain than convectional rain. It just sounds better. It's like in Homeros, there's a canoe that I saw on the beach called In God We Troust. The first thing you want to do is laugh, and the second thing you have to do is realize that the devotion and sincerity of the inaccuracy contains more faith than if any of us wrote In God We Trust, because we're lying. We don't really trust in God. But I think the man who lettered that canoe meant what he wrote, so it's better to have it, I think. And so there's a little error here about conventional rain. The epigraph is from Samuel Johnson for John Figaro. The irregular combination of fanciful invention may delight a while by that novelty of which the common satiety of life sends us all in quest. But the pleasures of sudden wonder are soon exhausted, and the mind can only repose on the stability of truth. I understand exactly how you feel. I don't understand it either. But it looks nice. I do understand it. I think maybe I got it from John, who had his moments of, you wouldn't call them pomposity, but let's just put it, a certain weight, let us say. So I think I got it from him. Insomniac since 4. By the way, if anybody's worried about being 40, 60 is terrific. Insomniac since 4, hearing this narrow, rigidly metered, early rising rain recounting as its coolness numbs the marrow that I'm nearing 40, nearer the weak vision thickening to a frosted pain, nearer the day when I may judge my work by the bleak modesty of middle age as a false dawn, fireless and average, which would be just because your life bled for the household truth, the style past metaphor, that finds its parallel, however wretched, in simple shining lines, in pages stretched plain as a bleaching bedsheet under a guttering rain spout, glad for the sputter of occasional insight. You who foresaw ambition as a searing meteor will fumble a damp match, and smiling, settle for the dry wheezing of a dented kettle, for vision narrower than a louver's gap. Then, watching your leaves thin, recall how deep, prodigious cynicism plants its seed, gauges our seasons by this year's end rain, which, as greenhorns at school, we'd call conventional for convectional. Or you will rise and set your lines to work with sadder joy but steadier elation until the night when you can really sleep, measuring how imagination ebbs, conventional as any water clerk who weighs the force of lightly falling rain, which, as the new moon moves it, does its work even when it seems to weep. Sea grapes. That sail which leans on light, tired of islands, a schooner beating up the Caribbean for home, could be Odysseus, homebound on the Aegean. That father and husband's longing under gnarled sour grapes is like the adulterer hearing Nausicaa's name in every gull's outcry. This brings nobody peace. The ancient war between obsession and responsibility will never finish, and has been the same for the sea wanderer or the one on shore, now wriggling on his sandals to walk home since Troy sighed its last flame and the blind giant's boulder heaved the trough from whose groundswell the great hexameters come to the conclusions of exhausted surf. The classics can console, but not enough. I have been very shaken by the death of Ted Hughes, who was a beautiful, gentle person, no matter what else one may read in the papers about him. It's regrettable that the papers do not respect the fact that the man they're writing about, who had his tragedies, had them 38 years ago, and that following that he had a quiet and firm marriage, which he had for 35 years. But good news is not news. Sea canes. Half my friends are dead. I will make you new ones, said Earth. No, give me them back as they were instead, with faults and all, I cried. Tonight I can catch their talk from the faint surf's drone through the canes, but I cannot walk on the moonlit leaves of ocean down that white road alone, or float with the dreaming motion of owls leaving Earth's load. O Earth, the number of friends you keep exceeds those left to be loved. The sea canes by the cliff flash green and silver. They were the seraph lances of my faith. But out of what is lost grows something stronger that has the rational radiance of stone, enduring moonlight further than despair, strong as the wind that through dividing canes brings those we love before us as they were, with faults and all, not nobler, just there. The Sadhu of Cuba, for Kenneth Ramchan. Here's an old Indian in Trinidad talking about his separation from his old country and the challenge of continuing in his faith. The attempt is to try to do it in an inflected Trinidad language or dialect, but with an effect that may echo an Indian talking. The Sadhu of Cuba. When sunset, a brass gong vibrate through Cuba, is then I see my soul swiftly unsheathed, like a white cattle bird growing more small over the ocean of the evening canes. And I sit quiet, waiting for it to return, like a hog cattle blistered with mud, because for my spirit, India is too far. And to that gong, sometimes bald clouds in saffron robes assemble, sacred to the evening, sacred even to Ramlochan singing Indian hits from his jute hammock, while evening strokes the flanks and silver horns of his maroon taxi as the mosquitoes whine their evening mantras, my friend Anopheles on the sitar, and the fireflies making every dusk Diwali. I knot my head with a cloud, my white mustache bristle like horns, my hands are brittle as the pages of Ramayana. Once the sacred monkeys multiplied like branches in the ancient temples, I did not miss them, because these fields sang of Bengal. Behind Ramlochan repairs there was Uttar Pradesh, but time roars in my ears like a river. Old age is a conflagration as fierce as the cane fires of crop time. I will pass through these people like a cloud. They will see a white bird beating the evening sea of the canes behind Coover, and who will point it as my soul unsheathed? Neither the bridegroom in beads nor the bride in her veils, their sacred language on the cinema hoardings. I talked too damn much on the Coover Village Council. I talked too softly. I was always drowned by the loudspeakers in front of the stores or the loudspeakers with the greatest pictures. I am best suited to stalk like a white cattle bird on legs like sticks, with sticking to the path between the canes on a district road at dusk, playing the elder. There are no more elders, it's only old people. My friends spit on the government. I do not think it's just the government. Suppose all the gods too old. Suppose they're dead and they're burning them. Supposing when some cane cutter start chopping up snakes with a cutlass, he is severing the snake-armed god. And suppose some hunter has caught Hanuman in his mischief in a monkey cage. Supposing all the gods were killed by electric light. Sunset, a bonfire roars in my ears. Embers of blown swallows dart and cry like women distracted around its cremation. I ascend to my bed of sweet sandalwood. This poem is called The Spoiler's Return, and I just want to say a few words about spoiler. Trinidadian Calypsonians give themselves, or used to give themselves, regal or noble titles like the mighty this, lord this, and lord that, and so on. As a matter of fact, so did a lot of American musicians. It would be very cheap and easy to say why they did that, maybe to elevate themselves to that position socially, but it's not socially. The competition is based on quality of the calypso, so that if you say, I am lord this, means I am lord of the calypso. It's not that I want to be an English lord. It's a very different kind of idea. Spoiler didn't make himself a lord, he just thought he'd call himself mighty, which is all right. Spoiler was he died like most of them, alcoholic and broke, revered but without money. An extremely witty Calypsonian and a very fierce satirist too. He has a calypso in which a magistrate, there's something, everything is based on, you know, on headlines and stuff that happened in Trinidad, an actual event. So the role of the Calypsonian is a role that is inviolable. It cannot be touched by the law. If someone tries to arrest a Calypsonian for libel, that's death, because what's going to happen is 15 more Calypsonians are going to write calypsos about the fact that you try to arrest, you know, so... Just leave it alone. Let it pass. Right? And there was a calypso from Spoiler in which he described a magistrate who tried himself, you know, himself doing this to himself and so on, out of the corruption of justice. And one of the refrains of Spoiler's calypso was something called the bed bug. And in the bed bug, he says, I'm going to bite them young ladies' partner like a hot dog or a hamburger. And if you're thin, don't be in a fright. It's only big, fat women are going to bite. And it's a beautiful melody, which is still sung, you know? So I knew about another English Calypsonian called Lord Rochester, the Earl of Rochester, who I don't think sang his stuff, but who also wrote in the same meter. And that may be a little bewildering for critics who have a sense of chronology, because if you went backwards, you wouldn't know which lines are Rochester's and which are spoilers, because I'll read them. You mustn't think that a Calypsonian limited his or her vocabulary, particularly his, to monosyllables. In fact, one of the skills was to be polysyllabically rhythmic. So if you come across the word prodigious and you say, oh, that's got to be Rochester, not necessarily. Were I, who to my cost already am, and you could play this in Calypso, one of those strange, prodigious creatures, man, a spirit free to choose for my own share what case of flesh and blood I pleased to wear. I hope when I die after burial to come back as an insect or animal. Now, I did my phony English accent for the last two lines. Those are spoilers, not Rochester's. So it should really go, what case of flesh and blood I please to wear. I hope I die after burial to come back as an insect or animal. That's it. That is the spoiler part. At the time that this is written, Trinidad is going through an astonishing boom in the oil industry that it had, and the waste and the showing off, the conspicuous greed was disgusting in many respects, and it would happen in any society. Spoiler comes back and he goes up on the hill called La Ventille, meaning the French for the windmill, La Ventille, right? Which is a windmill, an old windmill that overlooks an old estate overlooking the city of Port of Spain. In the Caribbean, the higher the shacks go, the greater the view. So the poor have the greatest view of the islands. It's only later the rich caught up with the poor in terms of trying to get the best view. Funny. So when he looks down here, he sees the city below him, and he has returned as a ghost. The references in here are to, one of them is to Desperados. Desperados is a fantastic steel band that has its tent, or its place, or rather its workplace, up on the top of La Ventille. So you associate Desperados with La Ventille. And I don't think there's much else to point out. It's done in an inflected kind of rhythm, language. And I'm going to read most of it. For Earl Lovelace. It's longish, so stand by. The spoilers return. I sit high on this bridge in La Ventille, watching that city where I left no will but my own conscience and rum-eaten wit. And limers passing see me where I sit, ghost in brown gabardine, bones in a sack and ball. Hey, spoiler boy, when you come back. And those who bold don't feel the out of place to peel my lime skin back and see a face with eyes as cold as a dead mackerel. And if they still can talk, I answer, hell. I have a room there where I keep a crown, and Satan sent me to check out this town. Down there that boy have a stereo where whole day he does blast my kaiso. I beg him 2 weeks leave, and he send me back up not as no bedbug or no flea, but in this limeskin hat and flocky suit to sing what I did always sing, the truth. Tell Desperados when you reach the hill, I decompose, but I composing still. I'm going to bite them young ladies' partner like a hot dog or a hamburger. And if you're thin, don't be in a fright. It's only big fat women I'm going to bite. The shark racing the shadow of the shark across clear coral rocks does make them dark. That is my premonition of the scene of what passing over this Caribbean is crab climbing crab back in a crab quarrel and going round and round in the same barrel. Is sharks with shirt jacks, sharks with well-pressed fins ripping we small fry off with razor grins. Nothing ain't changed but color and attire. So back me up, old brigade of satire. Back me up, Marshal, Juvenal, and Pope. To hang theirself, I given plenty rope. Join spoiler chorus, sing the song with me, Lord Rochester, who prays the nimble flea. Were I who to my cost already am one of those strange, prodigious creatures, man, a spirit free to choose for my own share what case of flesh and blood I please to wear. I hope when I die after burial to come back as an insect or animal. I see these islands and I feel to ball area of darkness with V.S. Nightfall. Lock off your tears. You're casting pearls of grief on a duck's back, a waxen dashing leaf. The slime crab's carapace is waterproof, and those with hearing aids turn off the truth, and their dark glasses let you criticize your own presumptuous image in their eyes. Behind darker glasses is just hollow skull, and black still poor, though black is beautiful. So crown and mitre me, bedbug the first. The gift of mockery with which I am cursed is just an insect biting fame behind, a vermin swimming in a glass of wine that dipped out with a finger, bound to bite its saving host and grateful parasite, whose sting between the cleft ass and its seat reminds authority man is just meat. A moralist as mordant as the louse that the good husband brings from the whorehouse. The flea whose itch to make all power wince will crush a fet even at his life's expense. And these pile up in lime pits by the heap daily that our deliverers may sleep. All those who promise free and just debate, then blow up radicals to save the state, who allow in democracy's defense a parliament of spiked heads on a fence. All younger ball out spoils, things ain't so bad, this ain't the dark ages, just Trinidad. Is human nature spoiler after all, it ain't big genocide, is just bobball. Safe and conservative, afraid to take side, they say that Rodney commits suicide. Is the same voices that in the slave ship smile at their brothers, boy is just the whip, I free and easy, you see me have chain. A little censorship can't cause no pain. A little graft can't rot the human mind. What sweet in goat mouth, sour in his behind. So I sing with Attila, I sing with Commander. What right in Guyana, right in Uganda. The time could come, it can't be very long, when they will jail Calypso for Pecan. For first comes television, then the press, all in the name of civic righteousness. It has been done before. All power has made the sky shit and maggots of the stars. Over those Romans lying on their backs, the hookers swaying their enormous sacks, until all language stinks and the truth lies, a mask for maggots and a fet for flies. And for a spineless thing rumor can twist into a style, the local journalist, as bland as a green coconut, his manner routinely tart, his sources the savannah. And all pretensions to a native art reduced to giggles at the coconut cart, where heads with reputations in one slice are brought to earth when they ain't eating nice. And as for local art, so it does go. The audience have more talent than the show. It's carnival, straight carnival, that's all. The beat is bass, the melody, bobball. All Port of Spain is a 12:30 show, some playing Kojak, some Fidel Castro, some Rastaman, but with or without locks to spoiler is the same old khaki socks. All Frederick Street stinking like a closed drain. Hell is a city, much like Port of Spain. Around the time I dead, it wasn't so. We sang the Commonwealth of Cayuso. We was in chains, but chains made us unite. Now, who have, good for them, and who blight, blight. My bread is bitterness, my wine is gall, my chorus is the same, I want to fall. Lord, let me take a taxi south again and hear drumming across Caroni Plain, the tabla in the Indian half hour when twilight fills the mud huts of the poor, to hear the tattered flags of drying corn rattle the sky from which all the gods gone, their bleached flags of distress waving to me from shacks adrift like rafts on a green sea. Things ain't gonna change. They ain't gonna change at all to my old chorus, Lord, I want a ball. The poor still poor, whatever arse they catch. Look south from Laventille, and you can watch the torn brown patches of the central plain slowly restitched by needles of the rain, and the frayed earth crisscrossed like old bagasse spring to a cushiony quilt of emerald grass. And who does sow and patch the land, the Indian, and whose villages turn sand? The fishermen doomed to stitching the huge net of the torn foam from point to Lafayette. One thing with hell, at least it organized in soaring circles. When any man dies, he must pass through them first. That is the style. Jesus was down here for a little while, cadaverous Dante, big guts Rabelais. All of them wave to spoiler on their way. Catch us in Satan tent next carnival. Lord Rochester, Quevedo, Juvenal, Maestro, Marshall, Pope, Dryden, Swift, Lord Byron, the Lords of Irony, the Duke of Iron, hotly contending for the monarchy in couplets or the old Re minor key. All those who gave earth's pompous carnival fatigue and groaned, oh God, I feel to fall. All those whose anger for the poor on earth made them weep with a laughter beyond mirth, names wide as oceans when compared with mine, salted my songs and gave me the high sign. Olive, excuse me. Spoiler was in town, you pass him straight, so now he gone back down. Just a couple more. I'll just do a couple more pages. I'm going to just read from the beginning of Omeros, in which a fisherman called Achille is choosing a canoe, which he then names In God We Trust. At the beginning of this, a man called Philoctet, who is Philoctetes, has a suppurating wound that stinks from time to time, as it happens in the actual legend. Oh, one sunrise, we cut down them canoes. Philoctet smiles for the tourists who try taking his soul with their cameras. Once wind bring the news to the Laurier Canal, their leaves start shaking the minute the axe of sunlight hit the cedars, because they could see the axes in our own eyes. Wind lift the ferns. They sound like the sea that feed us fishermen all our life, and the ferns nodded, yes, the trees have to die. So fists jam in our jacket, cause the heights was cold and our breath making feathers like the mist, we passed the rum. When it came back, it gave us the spirit to turn into murderers. I lift up the axe and pray for strength in my hands to wound the first cedar. Dew was filling my eyes, but I fire one more white rum, then we advance. For some extra silver under a sea almond, he shows them a scar made by a rusted anchor, rolling one trouser leg up with the rising moan of a conch. It has puckered like the corolla of a sea urchin. He does not explain its cure. It have some things, he smiles, worth more than a dollar. He has left it to a garrulous waterfall to pour out his secret down La Saussure, since the tall laurels fell, for the ground dove's mating call to pass on its note to the blue tacit mountains, whose talkative brooks, carrying it to the sea, turn into idle pools where the clear minnows shoot, and an egret stalks the reeds with one rusted cry, as it stabs and stabs the mud with one lifting foot.
Then silence is sawn in half by a dragonfly as eels sign their names along the clear bottom sand when the sunrise brightens the river's memory and waves of huge ferns are nodding to the sea's sound. Although smoke forgets the earth from which it ascends, and nettles guard the holes where the laurels were killed, an iguana hears the axes, clouding each lens over its lost name when the hunched island was called Iwanalau, where the iguana is found. But taking its own time, the iguana will scale the rigging of vines in a year, its dewlap fanned, its elbows akimbo, its deliberate tail moving with the island, the slit pods of its eyes ripened in a pause that lasted for centuries, that arose with the Arawak smoke till a new race unknown to the lizard stood measuring the trees. These were their pillars that fell, leaving a blue space for a single god where the old god stood before. The first god was a gommier. The generator began with a wind, and a shark with sidewise jaw sent the chips flying like mackerel over water into trembling weeds. Now they cut off the saw, still hot and shaking, to examine the wound it had made. They scraped off its gangrenous moss, then ripped the wound clear of the net of vines that still bound it to this earth and nodded. The generator whipped back to its work, and the chips flew much faster as the shark's teeth gnawed evenly. They covered their eyes from the splintering nest. Now, over the pastures of bananas, the island lifted its horns. Sunrise trickled down its valleys. Blood splashed on the cedars, and the grove flooded with the light of sacrifice. A gommier was cracking its leaves, an enormous tarpaulin with a ridgepole gone. The creaking sound made the fishermen leap back as the angling mast leant slowly towards the trough of ferns. Then the ground shuddered under their feet in waves. Then the waves passed. Ashiel looked up at the hole the laurel had left. He saw the hole silently healing with the foam of a cloud like a breaker. Then he saw the swift crossing the cloud surf, a small thing far from its home, confused by the waves of blue hills. A thorn vine gripped his heel. He tugged it free. Around him, other ships were shaping from the saw. With his cutlass, he made a swift sign of the cross, his thumb touching his lips while the height rang with axes. He swayed back the blade and hacked the limbs from the dead god knot after knot, wrenching the severed veins from the trunk as he prayed, "Tree, you can be a canoe or else you cannot." The bearded elders endured the decimation of their tribe without uttering a syllable of that language they had uttered as one nation. The speech taught their saplings from the towering babble of the cedar to green vowels of Bacampeche. The bois flow held its tongue with the laurier cannelle. The red-skinned logwood endured the thorns in its flesh, while the Arawak's patois crackled in the smell of a resinous bonfire that turned the leaves brown with curling tongues, then ash, and their language was lost. Like barbarians striding columns they have brought down, the fishermen shouted. The gods were down at last. Like pygmies, they hacked the trunks of wrinkled giants for paddles and oars. They were working with the same concentration as an army of fire ants. But vexed by the smoke for defaming their forest, blow darts of mosquitoes kept needling Ashiel's trunk. He frotted white rum on both arms, that at least those that he flattened to asterisks would die drunk, then went for his eyes. They circled them with attacks that made him weep blindly. Then the host retreated to high bamboo like the archers of Arawaks running from the muskets of cracking logs, routed by the fire's banner and the remorseless axe hacking the branches. The men bound the big logs first with new hemp and like ants trundled them to a cliff to plunge through tall nettles. The logs gathered that thirst for the sea which their own vined bodies were born with. Now the trunks, in eagerness to become canoes, plowed into breakers of bushes, making raw holes of boulders, feeling not death inside them, but use, to roof the sea, to be hulls. Then, on the beach, coals were set in their hollows that were chipped with an adze. A flatbed truck had carried their rope-bound bodies. The charcoal smoldering cored the dugouts for days till heat widened the wood enough for ribbed gunwales. Under his tapping chisel, Ashiel felt their hollows exhaling to touch the sea, lunging towards the haze of bird-printed islets, the beaks of their parted bows. Then everything fit. The pirogues crouched on the sand like hounds with sprigs in their teeth. The priest sprinkled them with a bell, then he made the swift sign. When he smiled at Ashiel's canoe in God we trust, Ashiel said, "Leave it, it's God's spelling and mine." After mass, one sunrise, the canoes entered the troughs of the surpliced shallows, and their nodding prows agreed with the waves to forget their lives as trees. One would serve Hector and another Achilles. Ashiel peed in the dark, then bolted the half door shut. It was rusted from sea blast. He hoisted the fish pot with a crab of one hand. In the hole under the hut, he hid the cinder block step. As he neared the depot, the dawn breeze salted him, coming up the gray street past sleep-tight houses under the sodium bars of street lamps to the dry asphalt scraped by his feet. He counted the small blue sparks of separate stars. Banana fronds nodded to the undulating anger of roosters, their cries screeching like red chalk drawing hills on a board. Like his teacher waiting, the surf kept chafing at his deliberate walk. By the time they met at the wall of the concrete shed, the morning star had stepped back, hating the odor of nets and fish guts. The light was hard overhead, and there was a horizon. He put the net by the door of the depot, then washed his hands in its basin. The surf did not raise its voice. Even the ribbed hounds around the canoes were quiet. A flask of absinthe was passed by the fishermen, who made smacking sounds and shook at the bitter bark from which it was brewed. This was the light that Ashiel was happiest in, when, before their hands gripped the gunwales, they stood for the sea width to enter them, feeling their day begin. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, the next stage of the evening is that Derek Walcott will take questions for about a quarter of an hour. Could we have the lights on in the hall, though, because we can't really see anything from here? Okay, right. Long pause, silence. Right, who's going to ask the first question?
They don't have to.
You don't have to, I'm told. Yes.
There is a lot of optimism in a lot of people about the Indian-African relations in the Caribbean, particularly when I go to that. Are you still very optimistic?
Yes. What I'm really optimistic about is not the politics. That's superficial, ephemeral, that passes. What I'm optimistic about is the reality of what a Trinidadian feels. Indian, African, Chinese. That's my optimism. It's not an optimism, it's a reality. The conduct that we judge men by is a part of history. Some of it is very old, and some of it is most of it is repetitious. I don't think that unless there's a technique, unless you find a situation that is so absolute that someone can virtually take over the island, there are possibilities, things can happen. You can have an overthrow of the government, as was attempted before, and people taking over and stuff like that. And that's possible in any society. But I don't see it. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't feel that hatred is possible. I don't feel that there is a beginning. For instance, the obvious one to develop is Muslim-Hindu, right? I mean, you can use that. That's a standard thing from
elsewhere. That's not exploited. It's other things are exploited. I know exactly what you mean. And for instance, the crime in the Caribbean is very high in terms of what happens. I wouldn't call it optimism, and I would even call it faith. It's something that has to do with the profundity of it is a belief that the experience that the Caribbean has gone through, in terms of slavery and indenture, and in terms of the reality of the proximity and friendship that exists between people get irritated, very irritated about politicians trying to manipulate prejudices. And the hope in that is that that will be recognized by the press, by other people, or by just people considering it to be stupid. I believe that's strong. I believe that's there. That's the kind of trust I have. It doesn't matter whatever incident happens. To me, those things are really unimportant. And what gets restored in human conduct is very profound, In the same way that hatred is continuous, in a sense. But the restoration of reconciliation happens. I don't see a division that deep happening. And up to now, I think that people are aware of the, stupidity that lies behind that kind of division, even if it appears to be economically explicable or historicable, historically explicable or racially whatever. I don't go by those things. To me, those are short-term images of any kind of conflict. And this includes the Holocaust. One would think that you couldn't come around out of that. But we have. And Jews have.
Yes. Rewriting the classics.
No, it's a wasted endeavor to do that. I don't. The book, this has come up a lot. I thought when I was doing this book, I thought, what's going to happen? There are going to be a lot of essays about parallels and et cetera, et cetera. There'll be more criticism than the book requires, in a sense. Obviously, the reason why the book has what it has is something I didn't invent. I mean, St. Lucia is called the Helen of the West Indies. It's called that because it changed hands 13 times. So when children in St. Lucia sing Helen of the West Indies, they are singing a Homeric name that somebody, their teachers may tell them what it is, or somebody may not know what it is. The names that I have in the book, like Hector and Achilles, are actual names in the village that you see. And the book is not a rewriting. It's a book of what references there are. All experience on this side of the meridian is referential and has to do with erasure and associations. It doesn't have to be an attempt to rewrite what is happening. If Whitman said, crossover muse, those overwritten accounts, the debts to the classics, to the past. He wasn't saying forget them. He was saying we have paid enough as America. We have paid off our debt to the origin of what America could be. The American experience is the crossing over that meridian into this, and this has happened to races. It's happened to all the nations of Europe are represented in Trinidad. I was saying this because the book is about associations, and what is never pointed out is that the book turns on the writer and bites the hand that makes it and says, stop writing this stuff. These people don't know what you're talking about. Why do you have to make these associations? Why can't they be in their own light? Well, in reality, if you're being very honest about the fact that you are a writer, you cannot smother associations. You cannot smother debt. And there's no point trying to do that. If I look, as I often said, if I look at a sail going on a horizon, if I look flying on a plane and looking down, and I look down on the Caribbean and I see one little canoe and a sail, I can't help the fact that that is an Odyssean image. That image, the first emblematic image that has remained there and has been defined from that image is that image of a single sail trying to get home. Why? It's not because a canoe is imitating Odysseus. That's the emblematic, inevitable association you make as a writer. Now, the guy who's in the boat doesn't know a damn about Ulysses. But in effect, that's exactly what he's doing, passing islands and being afraid of them and all that stuff. So whatever is permanent and real in terms of literature, it's not a matter of rewriting it. It's a matter of... The other image to think of is this, that Borges said once, that a man was so much in love with Don Quixote that he rewrote the entire thing perfectly, which is great. And of course, the great book that has done that as a template is Ulysses by Joyce. What I'm doing here is to use references to say that these are associations that are not shaped and finished. And that is our experience. Our experience is partial. For every race here, it's partial. There's not a complete memory, really, of anything. But does that mean that it's erasure? No. It means that we have to... I'm talking as if I were in the Caribbean. I'm about the Caribbean. That the Caribbean definition has got to be in that partiality, in that fragmentary thing. The thing that makes up the wholeness of what that thing is that partiality. It is is that fragmentary reality that makes the entity. And it, rather than stop and say, oh, well, it's not finished, we lost this, this happened, etc. It's part of the whole idea of how we reread the classics. And I think we read them with a closer immediacy than anybody reads them. I think we read Dante in the Caribbean or Homer in the Caribbean with a closer immediacy than a Greek now reads Homer. Because something, not because it's been renewed geographically, you can't help the fact that, you see, this is the dangerous thing in any definition of Caribbean work, that everything seems to be imitation. It's as if the islands said, oh my God, we have no identity because as an archipelago called the Aegean, what are we going to do? You know? The islands don't get up in the morning and say, I've got to have an identity. You know? And so I'm not making fun of your question. I'm just saying it's not a rewrite of the classics. It is a referential thing about those fragmentary things that make what our wholeness is.
Yeah, question up now.
My question is the connection with the criminal justice system in the Caribbean, the relinquishing of the Privy Council. How do you feel about this in the Caribbean first? Not necessarily your opinion on the death penalty, but the whole acting around the criminal justice system.
Well, I know, I'd have to be an expert on that. I'd have to be a lawyer to answer that. I don't know the intricacy of the question. I can't give you an answer. If you're asking me for my opinion about the death penalty, I don't know. I never have an answer for that. Maybe I'm afraid to confront it, or I don't want to confront it. You know, you get to a certain age and you think it's stupid to take somebody else's life because it took another person's life. It's pointless to me to do that. Pardon me?
It's a very strong call for restoration.
Very what? A strong cause?
For the restoration of capital punishment.
Well, I don't think it's been proven that the death penalty stops murder. I don't think there are any statistics that can prove that that stops murder. That it doesn't stop it. So, if it doesn't, why have it? It may be more pain in imprisoning a man for life. That, to me, seems to be the equivalent, or worse than a death penalty even, to tell someone, you know, your freedom is now finished and you're going to live in this cell for the rest of your life. That, I think, I would find unendurable, you know.
Lady here.
Well, because then in 1968, he came to Vienna and his poetry reading, which I chaired. And I'm very proud to stand at this here now to celebrate the fact that you're here still.
Hold what?
The view of humanism is just as being part of the world.
You have to be very careful that you don't sound like you're boasting. Not about yourself. If you give an honest as possible answer, you have to say this, and this is the part I don't like to say, but it's as real as if it was a disastrous truth. The average Caribbean conversation on a certain level is syntactically surprising, marvelous, that the exchange that can happen, the English that can be spoken, which is inflected from various islands, from various languages. In other words, in St. Lucia, when some of my friends, I came back once to St. Lucia and I heard my friends talking without any affectation, and it was a joy, because what was happening was that the English language, if you take the English language to the peak of its expression, according to society, it heads towards the taciturn. In other words, upper class Englishman uses as few words as possible, so that you really end up in, you know, inflected groans and sighs and mutters. And this is the people who produced Shakespeare, right? So they go, right. If you reverse that, that's what a cannibal does. But so you can say that the same thing happens between Caliban and Prospero. They just exchange grunts, except that that's not true. You know, let's just do it. I think if you take the quality of English prose in the last 50 years, a little more than that, maybe, what would you have in terms of the strength, grace, clarity of writing that has happened in English? Jean Rhys is one of the finest sentence writers in English. C.L.R. James is one of the finest writers of English. Here's Jean Rhys, a white Dominican woman. Here is C.L.R. James, a black, an African. And then there's V.S. Naipaul, who is again, obviously, one of the finest writers of sentences. That's a fact. That's in one island, two people, James and Naipaul. If you just jump over and go to Martinique, there's Aimé Césaire, Édouard Glissant, and now you have a phenomenal writer, Patrick Chamoiseau. Phenomenal. The three writers of that stature could come out of one island is very surprising, but it is to some degree inevitable, in the same way that you go up the islands and the same thing happens in terms of the prose of Jamaica Kincaid. You know, now if you go from place to place and try to explain why does that happen, and it doesn't turn into one of those alleged flashes, you know, of a culture in which the Mexican or the Spanish boom with Marquez and Fuentes and Octavio Paz and all these people, that's supposed to be a decree. You see, the person in charge of defining booms and boomlets, right, are critics from the center. You know, London will tell you when the boomlet is over, you know, in all the various periodicals. And then it's too late for you as a young Caribbean writer because, hey, the boom is over, you know. This is true also of painting. It's the tone that says, we don't do that anymore. You're still doing it, but we don't do it anymore. We don't tell stories in novels. We used to do that in the 19th century, but now we're not doing that anymore, young man, or whatever, you know. So there's always this address towards the outskirts of creation, of creativity, by the center. That continues. The center does not give up its aesthetics. It'll give up Burma. It'll give up any territory, but not the authority of art. It will not do that. What do? You just ignore that because, you know, it's silly and it's transient. In terms of what has been emerging from the Caribbean, it is phenomenal. The quality is really phenomenal, but it is also inevitable that it would happen because the silence that was imposed on people who came to the Caribbean, the prevention of expression, of self-expression of any kind, you know, one of the visits, this is an old thing everybody uses, and I don't want to just beat the same old point, but one of the astonishing things you'll read when you read Froude or Trollope is that they are astonished that the slaves don't go home and write sonnets. Because, you know, they work all day, and then eventually, since they're not producing a culture, because they'll be a little bit tired, then they say, you know, there are no people there in the true sense of the word, because you judge a culture by its people. But now that the ban has been lifted, you know, people are trying to express themselves a little, and they're doing it beautifully and very, very powerfully, and in different languages. So it's it was inevitable that it happened. There can't be all that ferment and conflict and interchange tonally and, you know, originally in terms of what dialects are, what languages are, and how dialects become languages. All of those with different roots, French, Spanish, English, Dutch, Danish, all that, in a very concentrated space, because the Caribbean itself is a small land mass. The Caribbean is the sea, and that's immense, you know. So when one thinks of the Caribbean, one tends to substitute the size of the sea for the size of the land, but the land is very small, and the developed land is very small. So the concentration of what has come out of the Caribbean in terms of its genius is a beginning. The ideal Caribbean writer would naturally contain all of those continents. In other words, there's not enough acceptance or search done on either side of, say, the African Indian thing. It's happening in music, and music is always an advance of taste in terms of changes. It's faster, and that does happen in Trinidad, for instance. You know, where different kinds of fusion are happening, and you get different names for that fusion of African and Indian music. That's another thing that is too strong, really, to organize to a point where you can have that kind of really deep, permanent racial division, I think.
Yes.
You're very well known, obviously, for your poetry. Your poetry is the main thing for the Nobel Prize, but you're very well known as well for your plays. You're very well known for your painting. I believe you're also interested at the moment in film. How do you see the relationship between these different art forms and the way you intend to pursue it in the coming years?
The thing about film is that all of these things are there. I think that the imagery that happens in the imagination of a filmmaker, even if that imagery is not imagination in terms of creating a new metaphor, or because you can't do a metaphor a film cannot do a metaphor. It can only do simile. And no matter how avant-garde it is, and you say, oh, I see, it's a metaphor for that, it's really cutting it to the just as far as simile can go, and that's the difference and advance. The thing that poetry goes beyond in terms of metaphor and simile. But in terms of simile, the echo that can happen in great filmmaking is not verbal, obviously, but what does happen is that the imagination of the filmmaker, of a great film poet like Kurosawa, you know, is you look at a Kurosawa frame, and you're related to Japanese calligraphy. It's exactly like the strokes are there, because that's the work of a poet, a great poet, Kurosawa, in terms of, you know, the visible. And because I myself do a lot of detailed storyboard painting, in addition to painting, because I know exactly what I want in terms of what I'm doing, and because I'm also writing the text, and because, you know, the frame of what I'm doing could be shaped, then everything is in use in film. You know, you have the narration, which may be there in the story, some in the dialogue in terms of a play, and everything is is in that. And the music, of course, which I don't write, but which does so much to amplify the width of a film. So it is a very exciting form. It's an expensive form, and I think it's going to happen that all of those terrific novels and stories that have come out of the Caribbean may someday develop into, you know, modest and fine movies. I mean, if I had the money at option, nearly every Caribbean novel has been written.
Okay, I'm afraid we said 15 minutes and we've gone on now for nearly half an hour, and as you can hear, I think Derek Walcott is beginning to get a cold, and we don't want him to lose his voice because tomorrow he has to go through the ceremony of having an honorary degree conferred on him here at the University of Warwick. So I'd like to thank you very much on behalf of the university and on behalf of everybody present. Thank you for a wonderful experience. Thank you.